Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordechai Joseph. We're today in lesson 64, and we might be able to finish the book of Matthew today. Anyway, we're in chapter 27, verse 25, and last time this is the scripture that we read, the final one. And all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." In other words, when on one hand Pilate goes through this charade, you know, of washing his hands, claiming himself to be innocent, and still at the same time, knowing that the person is innocent, knowing that he had done no wrong, knowing that they have done it out of envy, you see, as an unjust, you know, the epitome of the unjust judge, he still sentenced him to death, you see. No normal, sane person would ever do that if he's a judge. But this person, obviously, was not in his proper mental state, you see. Otherwise, he would not have done that. Because they have to go by the law. Judges, they don't make their own law, they have to go by the law. And the law says if the person is innocent, he cannot be charged, you see, and sentenced. And he knew very well the law of Rome was as such. With all the cruelty that was in Rome, they had respect for the law. And if somebody was not guilty, he was not charged with it and sentenced and executed, you see. So he was breaking the law of Rome. He was breaking the law of his own conscience. He knew the truth, you see. In essence, he was epitomizing the spirit of the world, the Gentile world in which he lived, and that's the way they functioned. The law was on one hand, but whenever it was expedient, you know, the law would be set aside and they'll do their own thing. And so for sake of expedience, because the Jews, in essence, were threatening him that if he does not do what they want, they're going to let Caesar know about it, because this is the person that supposedly is challenging Caesar, and the governor is not doing anything about it. That makes the governor a traitor, and so forth. So the whole thing was political, and there was nothing righteous here on the part of any one of them. And so he can claim himself to be innocent. He's not innocent in the sight of God. What he had done was willfully knowing that this man is innocent. The other ones were insane and drunk with envy and madness. So in one sense you can understand the desire for his death, because they were drunk, you see. This person was not. He knew exactly what was happening, and yet he did it anyway, and he thought that he could pretend and wash his hands and get it over with and not be guilty. Well, obviously God holds him guilty for that, because he condemned an innocent man, as later on the Apostle Paul would say. You know, had the rulers of this world had known who that person is, they would not have condemned him, you see. And that was also part of the problem. And so on the other hand, the people of Israel, the people of Judah, that is the priesthood at this point, we're not talking about the whole nation. The whole nation was not aware of it. Most of the multitudes followed him, so they're not in that category, even though in later generations it was convenient for the Gentile worlds, who themselves were responsible for the actual crucifixion, that is the people of Rome, the church of Rome, you see, you know, the armies of Rome, they are the ones that did it, knowing full well that the man was innocent. Well, they found it convenient to put all the blame on the Jews. And not only the few that were there responsible for it, you see, but they put it on the entirety of the Jewish race. Many who have never been to Israel in their life, and certainly didn't know what was happening there. And so the people, all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." Now that's foolish. You can never pronounce such a guilty verdict on innocent children who have not done it. So you see, on both sides, they're totally lawless in their statements, in their actions. And the reason why they were so irrational on both sides, obviously again, the devil enters into minds and hearts in accordance with the will of God, who wants it that way, because that's the only way this crucifixion would have taken place, and that's the only way the sacrifice would have been paid for the penalty of sin, for the sins of the world, in order to bring redemption to them. So unless you look at it from the point of view of God from the beginning until the end, you are not going to properly understand it, and therefore people develop, you know, all kind of emotions and feelings that are not based on objectivity, on reality, on understanding of the whole picture, you see. And so in that sense, you might say, many players are involved in it, and all of them have their own part. Some are doing it with malice and envy and hatred. Some are doing it because that's in terms of the Father and Jesus Christ himself being involved in it in order to bring salvation to men. You see? Yet they're all involved in the same act there with different motives. And so all the people are pronouncing a curse that they have no business doing because that's contrary to the law. You see? That their children also are going to be guilty of what they've done. Well, in essence, the children are going to be guilty and every single generation before and after will be guilty. Why? Because we all sin. That's why. You see? And of course, again, the children of the pagans, pagan Rome, and others took advantage of this statement. And they said, well, this is what you said. Your blood and the blood of your children be upon you, so we're going to kill you. You see? So, again, you see a criminal mind on both sides. And God is going to judge all of them. But that's contrary to the law of God, because the law of God made it very plain. The law that Jesus Christ himself gave to Israel through Moses, and he made it very plain that they cannot do such things. You see? He made it very plain that a person is responsible for his own iniquities, you see, and not for the iniquities of somebody else. And so in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 16, we read, fathers shall not be put to death for their children. You see, the children have committed murder. In other words, we're not talking about little, 3-year-old. But even, 3-year-old, 10 years old, sometimes, you drop something and somebody else, gets hurt and maybe get killed. You don't go and kill the father for it. And, there were children that were, criminal in nature. As they grow older, they're teenagers, just like they do today, they take guns and they kill one another. You don't go and kill the father. That's contrary to the law. A man should die for his own sin, not the sins of others. And so it's lawless to kill somebody who is not innocent, that is, who is not guilty, but innocent, just because somebody else in the family had done something wrong. And so he made it very plain. That's the law. This is the law of God. This is the law of Jesus Christ. He's the one that gave that law. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. You see? And the very few Jews that were responsible for it there, from the point of view of the law, if they are the criminals, they should be the ones to pay the penalty. So, in their ignorance and blindness, they can say all they want. We and our children are going to be, guilty of that blood. That's meaningless, you see, in the eyes of the law of God. You see? So, for people to conveniently use this statement against the entirety of the Jewish race shows what kind of spirit is in them. You see, there were children, in essence, spiritually speaking, of the devil, just like God said about his own people. Jesus Christ said to his own people. And he's not saying it about the whole race either, all of his people, because most of them were followers of him. But he's talking about the people that were constantly confronting him and having an evil attitude in their minds and hearts, who were criminal by nature, you see, and persecuting him. So again, he was not labeling, with a broad brush, everybody, you see. Because after all, his disciples, they were all Jews, and all of his followers, and the whole body of Christ, for the first century, for the majority of it in the beginning, was all Jewish, you see. But, again, criminal minds don't like to look at it that way. They're not interested in being confused with the facts. And so they go from one extreme to the other, and they're both in the same ditch. And so he made it very plain, don't do things like that. And so the people of Israel, when they were obedient to the law of God, they obeyed this law. And obviously, when you're disobedient, you couldn't care less. You see an example of that in 2 Kings. There was a king. His name was Joash. And his father, Amaziah. I'm sorry. In verse 14. I'm sorry, in chapter 14 of 2 Kings, in verse 1, we read about Amaziah, the son of Joash, and he became the king of Judah. And earlier, we read that his father Joash was killed by his own servants, as we read in chapter 12. And verse 19, now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And his servants arose and formed a conspiracy and killed Joash in the house of the Milo, which goes down to Selah. And then he mentions some of the people that have done it, some of the servants. Well, the king is dead now, and later on his son becomes the king, and his son reigns over Judah now. And now, you know, when he gets bolder and more powerful, you know, he decides to take care of those servants that have killed his own father. And so we read in verse 5 of chapter 14, now it happened as soon as the kingdom was established in his hand that he executed his servants who had murdered his father, the king. Well, that's in accordance with the law of God. The servants had done it. The servants were murderers. The servants, they were being murdered in turn. As Jesus Christ made it very plain, they who lift up the sword shall perish by the sword. And that's what they've done. And according to the law of God, you see, they deserve that punishment because they were guilty and not innocent. But, verse 6 we read, but the children of the murderers he did not execute according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, in which the Lord commanded, that's Jesus Christ, commanded, saying, fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers, but a person shall be put to death for his own sin. You see, quoting that law, which is read in Deuteronomy. And so, when the Jews here make such a statement, obviously they're not thinking straight, you see, and you cannot use that statement against them. You know, their sons, their daughters and children, you know, that came after them, generation after generation after generation. And yet that's exactly what the Gentiles have done. And many of them were, unfortunately and tragically, Israelites who thought they were Gentiles, and they've done just the same. And to this very day, there are some people who still have this attitude. You see, you're Christ killers. And you find them all over the earth, wherever they are, those who call themselves Christians, who are anything but that. You see? And so that's an unfortunate statement. But again, all of us are going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ for our own actions, and nobody's going to be playing games at that time. And so this is what happens here. And then we read in verse 26, then he released Barabbas to them. And when he had scourged Jesus, why do you have to scourge him? He's innocent, you see. If he's innocent, and you found him to be innocent, and you found no justified allegation that was really reality, you see, was just a concocted one against him, why do you scourge him? You see, and the kind of scourging that he received marred his face and his body, and he was not recognizable. So what kind of a judge in his sane mind would ever do a thing like that to an innocent man? You see, he's extremely guilty in doing that, because that's, you know, utmost cruelty to realize that every whiplash and every pain and every affliction that you brought on this man was done against an innocent man. How can anybody justify this act and then summon their insanity and idiocy and lunacy of mind? They claim, well, you know, when Jesus Christ was on the cross, you know, he absolved the Gentiles, you know, the soldiers, and you know what they've done. You see? What kind of a mind produces such kind of a thought? A lawless mind. And they've been doing it, you know, for centuries, for 2,000 years. You see? Saying that, you know, the Gentiles were not guilty, Rome was not guilty, you know, it's all the fault of the Jews. And besides, they say, you know, let his blood be on us and on our children. They can say all they want. What does that mean? It means nothing. You see, we're dealing with the law of God, not with the foolishness of men. You see, and so here it is. He's scourging him. No reason whatsoever for him to do it. He knows very well who that person is. You see, at least he knows that he's the king of the Jews. And he knows that he's a righteous man, and he knows that he's a prophet, and his own wife warns him because she has dreams. He's listening to nobody, you see. All he cares about is his own skin. He does not want to be accused before Caesar. And apparently he already was having some difficult times governing the land, so he was having some problems with Caesar probably before that. And he was not about to endanger his own position, you see. That's the mind of the Gentile. That's a bestial mind, you see. That's why they are referred to oftentimes in the scriptures as animals, like you see in the book of Daniel, they're described as animals, as beasts. But then again, anybody who becomes lawless, you know, acts like a beast of the field, you know, just like the people of Judah here, you know, the priesthood and the mob and all that. They were also asking, like, you know, acting like animals, you see, and all of them were in the same category, unfortunately. But still, that does not mean that every single Gentile all around the earth, you know, was responsible for it on a personal basis, you see, and does not mean that every single Jew is responsible for it on a personal basis, except that the fact is that all of us sin, and in that way, we're all guilty of it, you see, so you have to distinguish one from the other. But here it is, he's scourging an innocent man, and he delivered him to be crucified, you see, scourging and then crucified. And, you know, sort of adding insult to injury. And there was no need for any one of that, because he was not guilty and he should not have been scourged. There is a law. God says, if certain, you know, some people commit certain iniquity, this should be whipped with 40 lashes and not add, you see, lest your brother be held in contempt before you, you see, in your own sight. You know, you beat someone to pulp, then you couldn't care less about that thing. You know, it's no more a human being to you, you see. And a demonic spirit enters into a person like that, that loves blood and cruelty. And lots of people go berserk and insane when they torture others. You see, they totally lose themselves, so they don't realize what spirit is in them. And in scourging, that's often the case, you know, what they've done. They did not give them 40 lashes and ceased in order not to despise them. They just scourged them to the point where you couldn't see any healthy skin anymore on the flesh. And that's the utmost of cruelty, and the Jews never had done that. You see, they whipped people, they stoned them to death, but with all their cruelty, they would never scourge a person, you see, in the manner the Romans had done. So that shows you, you know, the viciousness and the wickedness that was in this people, you see, and the cruelty that was there, totally void of mercy, and that was the nature of Rome, unfortunately. At least the ones who were doing it, I mean, you know, not that every single human Roman, you know, was that kind of a person, but that, unfortunately, was the nature of the government and the leadership and the soldiers, and, you know, that's the way they treated everybody else. And a lot of people to this very day were thinking that way and acting like in that manner. Utterly void of mercy. And so they scourge him and they crucify him. And all this process is the most horrible, hideous kind of death that you can inflict on a human being. And yet, you see, in all that, this was the will of God. A lot of people, you know, have a difficult time with that. They cannot understand it. How can God, who is love, on one hand, cause a thing like that to happen, you see, and it's not to his enemy, as his own son? Imagine that. We can comprehend that, because in doing so, when we come to understand it, we see the hideousness of sin, the consequences of it, the viciousness behind it. You see, the malice, the evil. And Christ took it all upon himself, you see. And we do not have, as human beings, really a fullness of capacity to really comprehend that kind of love. You see, and therefore a lot of people, you know, they stood over there and saw it, they would have turned against God and hated him passionately for allowing such a thing to happen. As it is, a lot of people say, well, if God is love, well, how come? You know, how come Johnny died, and how come the Holocaust, and how come this, and how come that? And they don't realize what he was willing to allow his own, you know, son, the one that became his son, that has been with him for eternity, to go through for us, you see. If God said, my ways are not your ways, my thoughts are not your thoughts. So we do not have the capacity to really comprehend what is happening here, even though, you know, we can read it and we can understand, you know, intellectually, well, you know, he died for our sins. But to understand it emotionally and psychologically and, you know, really comprehend what is happening here, it's extremely difficult. It's not easy. Especially if your son is involved or your own daughter in the process. You see, somebody very close to you, maybe your own self. It's very difficult to understand it. And you have to have the nature of the divine to comprehend it fully. But at least this is what we see here. That was an expression of the awesomeness of love that God had for us. And on the other hand, conversely, as much as he loves us, that's how much he hates sin. And therefore he could not compromise. And yet there are all those people walking around. First, they say the law is done away with. which defines sin, as Paul said, how would I know what sin is unless the law said, you know, you shall not commit adultery or covet or whatever, you see? And then others say, well, you know, okay, I'll do this and that, but the others are not, important for salvation. They're not necessary for salvation. Instead of understanding the hideousness of sin, be it small or big, and what it does to the body, how it corrupts the spirit, the character, the nature. And therefore Christ had to go through that, and still people claim to be servants and followers of Christ on one hand, and then despise and have contempt his law. They despise his law, his very nature, for which he had to die because of the transgression of it. You see? So you can see an awful lot of people are totally insane, and they have no comprehension, no appreciation whatsoever of the sacrifice of Christ, and yet they claim to be Christians, you know, followers of Christ. And so this is what is happening here. He delivered him to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Now they're going to mock him, you see. There was no need to do it. They too knew he was innocent. So why do you do it to an innocent person? How can you justify yourself just by washing your hands and claim, well, I'm innocent of that, when you go ahead and do all these evil things? Well, there was absolutely no reason for them to do it. No legal justification, you see. No moral justification for it. So you can see how twisted their minds were. And that's the way we are, you know. We do whatever we do and then we justify ourselves. And so it says, when they had twisted the crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand, totally mocking him and having utter contempt for him. An innocent man. A Jew or not a Jew, he was an innocent man and they knew it. You see? So, God makes it very plain. How much guilt is there on the part of those Jewish leaders, and how much guilt is on the part of Rome and the soldiers of Rome. You see? And had the people of Rome been there, you know, they are the ones that always enjoyed all those massacres in the Colosseum, you see, with the animals tearing, you know, people to pieces. You know, that's the nature of men when the devil enters into their minds and hearts and nobody is innocent. You see, none of us is innocent before God. And we should always remember that. A lot of people like to justify themselves and say, I'm holier than thou, and blame the others, demonize the others, when they themselves are as rotten as they can be. And so they've done that, and they put it on his head, you know, and a rod in his hand, you know, making fun of him. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews! You see, here they have an opportunity to show their utter contempt for the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, innocent or not innocent, couldn't care less. They were not interested in that. Again, they're disobeying their own laws, the laws of Rome, that forbid, according to the law of Rome, to punish a guiltless person, an innocent person, you see, with all the perversion and all the cruelty, they still had that law. And they generally did abide by it, and so they maintained harmony and order, at least to a degree, in their empire. Now what happens when their own soldiers and their own governors despise that very law, you see? Well, then this is what happens here. Then again, you know, Christ is involved in it, God is involved in it, and he allows the demons and the devil to get involved in it. And so all those things are for the end purpose, you see? And the end purpose is for man to be redeemed, and for God to make it possible. He had to take all those iniquities and all the viciousness and all the malice and all the cruelty and all the sins of men upon himself willingly in order to regain them back, you see? And when you consider the fact that when you kill a man, that's it, that's the end of the story. But when God kills a person or allows a person to be killed, he's in charge of life and death. There is no death in his presence, you see. He brings the person back to life. So you have to understand all those things, and then you really comprehend, at least to a degree, what is happening here and why. And so then they spat on him, and again, had no reason to do it, and they took the reed and struck him on the head. Again, why would you do a thing like that for? He's an innocent man. So there is a much more here in the account to show the cruelty of Rome, of the Gentile Rome that later on became the church, the cruelty of the Gentile mind, the bestiality that is in it, which future generations demonstrated that very bestiality and hatred and cruelty and mocking, you see, against the Jew. You see, so in essence, they continued to crucify Jesus Christ through his kinsmen and hate him, and they still do, and they will continue to do so in a much more severity. As the Bible makes it very plain, the coming final martyrdom and destruction and pillaging and murder and rape and all that, not only the followers of Christ who have his spirit, but also the people of Christ, the people of Judah, you see, and the people of Israel, who are all of the same nation, the same people. So they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off him, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to be crucified. Now, in all those years where they played, you know, this called the Passion, you see, the Passover plot, they put all the blame on the Jew. They didn't bring, you know, the role of Rome, the Gentile Rome, of which they are the descendants. Just like the Pharisees were saying, well, had we lived in that generation, we would not have killed the prophets. And Christ told them, you're testifying against yourself that you are guilty, that you are the sons of those prophets. And these very people who generation after generation had done the very thing that they've done to Christ, to his own kinsmen, the people of Judah for whom he died and he loved to the end, and he's going to redeem them. And as Paul made it very plain, all of Israel shall be saved because God loves them and is going to bring them back to himself. And so here it is, the Gentile continues to crucify Jesus, you see, through his disciples, or his disciples-to-be, when he deals with them, when the Father, you know, calls them and opens their eyes. And they haven't seen that in this light in the last 2,000 years. And so if any one of you who is a Jew hater or a hater of the law, there is your description. This is what you are. God is describing you here, your spirit, your nature, your character, for what you are. And when the day comes, not even the grave will save you from the day of wrath and fury of Jesus Christ for what you have done to his own brothers and sisters. You see, you can play all the games that you want now and call yourself Christians. When the time comes, you will stand before the seat of judgment, you see, and being lawless for what you are. This is what Christ is going to tell you. I never knew you. You see? Why would he know a person who crucifies him all the time and hates him and despises him and despises his law? And this is not the story that was being told from the churches, be it the Catholic, the Protestant, you know, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, and all those people. They're not telling this story from the point of view of God. That's how he describes it. So he's describing the nature of the beast that is still there to this very day. In the heart of people that call themselves followers of Christ. What a mockery. And so in verse 32, we continue now. As they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. And when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, place of the skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. And apparently that was something to strengthen the person so he can continue. And at the same time, you can see the cruelty in it. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink, you see, because vinegar oftentimes gives you strength to go on, to take the pain, you know, to kill the pain, but he had to experience every single pain that was inflicted on him that was a part of paying the penalty for the Jew, you see, and the Gentile, because ultimately they're all his children, even though they were acting at this point, as many still do, as many have done in the past, like sons of the devil, unfortunately, sons and daughters of the devil. But that's the love of God. In spite of all that, he's going to redeem us from ourselves, from the devil, from sin and iniquity, and majority of humanity, not all of them, are going to be in the kingdom of God, ultimately, as brothers and sisters, no more haters of one another. And so, then they crucified him and divided his garments, casting lots again. God was the one in charge of this recorded detail of history and inspired to begin with, and the one that did, in essence, was Jesus Christ himself, who inspired David to write about that, as you can read it in Psalm 22. And so they divided his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, and you see it written again, as I said, in advance, as God recorded it, or inspired one of his servants to record it, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Verse 36, sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Imagine that. To see a person in that horrible torment, you just sit down there and you watch, you gawk at it. Shows you the bestial nature that is in man. You sit on the freeway all the time, there is an accident, and you know, everybody slows down. They want to watch. They want to see. You see, there's something very fiendish in our spirit. There's something satanic, you know, vicious, malicious in our heart and mind. We want to see pain, suffering, torment, anguish, agony, misery. We go to see those kind of movies. We love violence. And we don't know of what manner of spirit we are until God is going to root it out of our minds and our hearts by giving us a taste of our own medicine. And so they just sat down there and, you know, having their own lunch, so to speak, and looking at him. You know, it was fun, you know. For, you know, they had the front row, and that's what they were doing. And they put up over his head the accusation written against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. And he put the entirety of the account together, and basically said, this is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Then two robbers were crucified with him. Now, they were robbers. They were not innocent. They were guilty, you see. So that was a different story for them. But even then, according to the law of God, this kind of crucifixion and punishment was unlawful, you see. But, you know, the Gentiles, what do they know about the law of God? What do they care about it? And to this very day, they couldn't care less about it. So that's what they did here. And yet they put them sort of to shame and to humiliate, you know, Jesus Christ. Here is an innocent man in the midst of two robbers. Just like you take an innocent man and you put them among the hardened criminals in prison when he hasn't done anything wrong. And so it shows you, you know, the viciousness of the mind that was behind it and the spirit that is behind it. And so this is what they've done here, one on the right, one on the left, and those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads, you know, either the soldiers or, you know, the people there whose minds were poisoned against their own creator and maker who was in the process of bringing them salvation and redemption, and they were totally ignorant and oblivious to it. Still are most to this very day. And if not for the patience of God, the long-suffering, the mercy, the kindness, you know, all of us would have been put to death long time ago. Verse 40, and, you know, so they're wagging their heads at him, and they were saying, you who destroy the temple, you know, because he said, I can destroy this temple and build it in 3 days, never understanding what he said, and he did not bother to tell them what he meant by that. He said, you who destroy the temple, you know, you were bragging about it, that he can do it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Likewise, the chief priests, who also mocking with the scribes and elders, said, he saved others. And that's a condemnation against themselves. They knew that he saved others, you see. And they didn't realize what they were seeing at this point. They were pointing the finger at themselves, that they knew he was innocent, that they knew that he's a man of God, that they knew that he saved others, you see. And so they said it, because all of them were in an incensed state of mind. That's why he said to, you know, when he looked at them, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they are doing. He did not lash back at them and curse them, you know, and spoke evil, malicious words against them. And so they said, he saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, as if they didn't know, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. So he had done all those things before that they didn't believe him. Why would they believe him now? You see? But that's the nature of man. Well, you know, you show me that and I'll believe you. Well, they show a person that. Well, he says, well, okay, they show me the other thing, then I'll believe you, and so forth. And so it wasn't among the children of Israel. No matter what God had done for them, they still doubted him and had no faith. Because people have no faith, it doesn't make any difference what you do. There is no faith in them. Because only God can give you that kind of faith, and he's not going to give it to a rebellious mind to begin with. You know, a diseased mind. Verse 43, they say he trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. So now they are mocking the Father, mocking God. You see, that's how insane their minds were because of the evil spirits that were in them at that time. And they obviously did not realize what they were doing. And so we continue in verse 44. Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. Now both of them are in that state of mind, and later on, one of them comes back to his senses and repents, in essence, while there on the cross. In other words, he realizes his attitude is wrong, And then in another account you read about his repentance and his desire for salvation. And then verse 45, we read, now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, that is from 12 to 3 o'clock. We read here, there was darkness over all the land, and about the ninth hour, about 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, in other words, my God, why have you forsaken me? And that was again a statement that long ago, God has inspired David to write that very one in Psalm 22. And it's very interesting, this was one of the statements that was on the lips of many Jews as they were going through the Holocaust, the concentration camps right before the crematorium, and things like that. And there is a very, very moving melody, my God, why have you forsaken me? That whenever you hear it, you know that this is what it is all about. They were singing it because they saw what was happening to them in the concentration camps and the Holocaust, and they realized nobody was listening to their prayers. And so they felt that God has forsaken them. Well, that was true. God has forsaken them, not all the way. And it was true here too. God had forsaken Jesus Christ because that was a part of the plan. He had to allow him to go through it until the end, and he was not about to deliver him before that, or else the whole plan of salvation, not only for the Jews, not only for Israel, but for all mankind, would never become a reality. So here it is, for the very people that were doing all those things to him, both Jew and Gentile, he had to go through that, and obviously it was very painful for him, so out of pain he was saying that. In reality, ultimately speaking, God did not really forsake him. It was just a phase he has to go through. And death was not going to separate him from God anyway. Verse 47, some of those who stood there, when they heard that, they said, this man is calling for Elijah. Because it says Eli, Eli, which is, that's the name of Elijah, the short name of it, Eli, Elijah, Eliyahu. Immediately one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and offered it to him to drink. Why would he do it? Well, that gives his strength to overcome the pain, you see. It's not necessarily to torment him or torture him, but obviously he did not want that. He had to go through the pain for the sake of the ultimate sacrifice. And the rest said, let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come to save him. And again, the nature of cruelty was still there through many. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. You see, that was the end of the story. And the penalty was paid. Pain was no more, you see. Now he's totally unconscious. He's dead. His spirit goes back to the Father, just like ours when we die. And still, you see, unless God resurrects, you see, a person, and we don't fully comprehend, the concept of resurrection, you see, or birth, we have limited minds to comprehend and understand it. We know a lot of things about it, but not fully, you see. How do you exist and then you don't exist? You see, and then you die, and then you come back to life again. Those are divine matters. But in the sight of God, he was still alive, you see. Just like he calls Abraham and Isaac and Jacob his servants, and Christ said he's the God of the dead, he's not the God of the living. Because he can bring them back to life, or he call them to life, a stage of life, any time he wants. And in the resurrection, he's going to do it for all mankind. For Jesus Christ, his resurrection was coming 3 days later. But at that moment, he was dead, unconscious. He was not thinking. There was a person coming out of him as a show, in movies. And, another person goes and talks and thinks and walks, you see, and communicates. There's no such a thing. That's a pagan doctrine that came up because of the pagan doctrine, of heaven and hell. And that's a pagan concept, that is a result of that. But when he was dead, he was totally dead. And if the Father had not resurrected him, 2,000 years ago, he still would have been dead to this very moment. That's what the resurrection is. When God puts that spirit that was in us, which is electricity, and that's all it is, into the machine again, which is the body, just like, pull off the cord and there is no electricity, well, the machine goes dead. You put it back in and it comes back to life, so to speak. And so he was dead. And because he had to die for us, And so he gave up the spirit, and when you do, that's the end of life. You don't function anymore because the spirit needs a body to function through, and without it, it cannot. It's useless. And then, behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked, and the rocks were split. An awful lot of witness there. And the veil, obviously, was the one that was separating between man and God. And only the high priest, once a year, could go through, you see, by offering blood to purify himself and the sins of Israel before God. Well, now the door was open. Access to God now is given, you see, to all men that God would call. You see, the access was not open to all men, but it was open to all men that God is going to call them. They are the only ones who are going to be able to go through, you see, through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. You cannot just say, well, I accept Christ. You don't accept Christ. Christ has to accept you. The Father has to call you and say, I want you, and then Jesus Christ is going to be revealed in you by living his life in you in obedience, not disobedience to the law of God. People thinking, all they have to do is accept Christ. It's all in vain. That's vain worship that you have after that. You can do all the good that you want, which is fine. That's not going to make you a follower of Christ. And the only way you will be is when the Father himself calls you personally and gives you to Jesus Christ, and now Christ begins to work with you, you see, and live his life in you. And so this is what is happening here with the veil being torn. And gradually God was going to call few, you know, the pioneers, and then the resurrection. All those who are going to be brought back to life will be given the opportunity again to have access to God and to become followers of Christ. And then in the second resurrection, 1,000 years later, all mankind, all those who ever lived, and were not resurrected in the first one, in which only the saints were resurrected. And so this is what we read here. And the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. They were dead all this time. They were not in heaven. They were not in hell. They were in the grave. And so those dead bodies, probably people that died not too long ago, because people recognize them. And God, you know, to testify of his power over life and death, you see, that's another witness of his Son. And that the fact that he overcame death for himself and for mankind. And so this was his sign also. And they rose. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they were not raised at that moment. You see, only when he was resurrected, because he was to be the first begotten of many. But the difference between him and them, he went up to heaven and he's still there, while they lived a natural life, a few more years, and died anyway after that. And they're still dead to this very day, awaiting another resurrection. So that was a temporary thing. You see, they revived temporarily, lived, and then died. And so they came out of the grave after his resurrection. They went into the holy city and appeared to many. And many knew them. You see, if you lived there 500 years before that, nobody would know. But there were people who were at the time alive, and therefore people recognized them, and that was a part of the witness. So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake, that is, you know, they saw what's happening there, they felt it, and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, truly, this was the Son of God. But that was, again, a superstitious reaction. That does not mean from now on they were going to obey him and follow him and have his law formed in them, written in their hearts. You see, a lot of people are that way. Well, they just saw a big thing, they're impressed by that, and they acknowledge whatever they acknowledge. That does not mean that they are followers of God. They still do their own thing. And many women who followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, were there looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and John's, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. Several Marys there. Now, when evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, and tradition tells us that he was the uncle of Mary, the mother of Jesus, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus Christ. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body, and obviously he was a man of reputation. You cannot just, you know, anybody walks into Pilate and ask for that. Then Pilate commanded the body to be given to him, probably gave him some money. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb and departed. So he was a rich man, therefore he could do that. And again, that was a part of the story. And in essence, in the family, you know, so, they took care of the matter. You know, if he was the uncle of Mary, so the whole matter remains within the family. It's not a stranger that does it. And Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary sitting opposite the tomb. On the next day, which followed the day of preparation, you see, that's a major detail here in explaining to you when it happened and when was the Passover at that time, you see, because on the day of preparation, this is when Christ was crucified. That's before the feast, before the Passover. It was still the day of preparation, you see. And so here we read, on the next day, which followed the day of preparation, because on the day of preparation he was killed, but on the next day, which followed the day of preparation, the chief priests and the priests gathered together to Pilate. So in essence, they're doing it after the holiday had passed, you see, because they could not do it on the holiday, saying, "Sir, we remember while he was still alive how that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise.' Therefore command that the tomb be made secure until the third day," because that's what he said, "I'll be there for 3 days. And lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say to the people, 'He has risen from the dead.' So the last deception will be worse than the first." To them it's still a deception, and there is no deception about it. You see, they're persistently, in spite of the fact that they know better, they're denying everything. And until next time, this is again Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people.